Our next guest is a television producer, the author of a powerful new book entitled Grateful Guilt, Living in the Shadow of My Heart. He's got quite an incredible story to tell, and we are pleased to be joined this afternoon by author Stephen Taibbi. Stephen, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you very much, Rich. I appreciate it.
It really is a remarkable story, and it goes back even before you had not one but two heart transplants. As you say, you've been living much of your life, really since childhood, with what we call an expiration date.
Yeah. They've had it wrong several times, fortunately.
Well, we're glad to hear that. So dealing with all kinds of medical issues in your life, but you were able to persevere and forge a very successful career. What led to you becoming a producer?
Well, I actually was a freelancer. So I did producing, writing, directing. I was a DP, director of photography, which is what I did a lot of. But I had I did it all, actually. What did it that was because I'd been told I wasn't going to get out of my 20s by that, by the time I was hitting, when I was 17, I almost died on my birthday. And then I was told I wouldn't get out of my birthday, out of my 20s. So I decided that I wanted to live the life I wanted to live. And I wanted to, I didn't want to have a J-O-B, I didn't want people telling me what to do. I'm kind of that way. I'm a snooty guy. And I just decided that I was going to live my life. So I became a freelancer in television. I went to college for it. I did multiple internships for it. I loved being in television. And that's what I decided to do. I decided that I could be my own boss. And I could be in a thing that I didn't have to work every day, and I could make good money, and I could enjoy my life, and that's why I picked that.
Now,
I was in love with photography since I was a child. So
am I being an amateur psychologist here? If I wonder if having a medical condition that might make you sometimes feel that you have a lack of control led you to look for a career that gave you the opportunity to have a great deal of control.
Yeah, when you're a director, you have a lot of control. And when I first started when you first start in television, you have to work your way up the ladder. And I started like everybody else did, by coiling cables and sweeping floors and making coffee. That's how you start. And but even when I was, a cameraman, when I first started as a cameraman, I could see that I was going to be a director. And I just grew into being a director in just a couple of years because I had ideas. I was I'm strong-willed, and I just managed to become a director relatively quickly. And that just suited everybody because I did a good job at it. And one of the tricks I found for being a good director, whether it was a director of photography or the director, was that I always gave credit to everybody. So if somebody else came up with a good idea, I wouldn't take the credit for it. I always make sure they got the credit for it, which is unusual in that business. And that made me, first of all, if I was, let's say, a director of photography, it made the producers and directors see, wow, the crews like to work with him. They do these things for him, And if I was a director, then the crews knew I was that way, and they'd work harder for me. It always worked out for everybody's benefit to you do better when you take as little credit as possible.
Absolutely. Yeah, and you worked with some very notable people on the way, from Richard Lewis to Joan London and even Dr. Ruth Westheimer.
Yeah, I did both of her cable shows. Pretty funny, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's funny. We have a professional theater company here that's doing the one-woman show that's based on the life of Dr. Ruth later on in the springtime.
Really?
Absolutely.
She's a riot. I got to tell you, she's an absolute riot. I love working with Ruth.
Still going strong, too. We are talking with Stephen Taibbi here on Downtown. His book is called Grateful Guilt, Living in the Shadow of My Heart. You were in your 40s when you had your first transplant?
Yeah, I was... I was 47 when I had my first transplant, and then I was 61 when I had the second one.
What is the mental side of all that? Obviously, there's a physical toll, but in terms of the preparation and then after the surgery, what are the biggest challenges mentally?
Well, see, I always consider this to be positives for me. I had when I was 5 years old, I had something called ASD, which is atrial septum defect. Everybody knows that as a hole in the heart. And when I was five, I had that operation, the ASD repair. And at that time, that was the cutting-edge surgery of the day, by the way. That was the biggest thing they were doing. And there was always children because it's a birth defect. And when I had my operation when I was five, only 50% of the children were living through that. When I had the second operation when I was six, nobody had lived through it yet. I was the first one. Mm. And, you know, when they come in and they give you last rites, which I did, they gave me the day before the operation, and you're an Italian Catholic kid lying in a Catholic hospital, you know what that means.
Mm.
And it just changed my head. I mean, I always fought, but now, you know, once I did that, once I realized that when I was 6 years old, I'd beaten death already when I was five, but I didn't really quite realize it. But once I was six and I realized I had really beaten death, that had really changed my mind. It had changed me mentally in a lot of ways. It was one of the reasons why in school I was the way I was, because I would get teachers yelling at me, and I'd be looking at them going, "The hell with you. I almost died. You've never even done nearly what I've done. Why am I listening to you?" Which is why I became a freelancer. So by the time I was, you know, I had been told everything was fine. After the scare when I was 17, I almost died on my birthday. And they had said, you know, you're not going to get out of your 20s. I managed to actually be okay again. And they told me, "We don't know what you did, but you beat it." You know, I had become a pilot. I owned an airplane. I owned a glider. And then suddenly, I'm sick again. And I got sick because I caught a virus. It had nothing to do with my heart. I caught a virus that went into my heart. So, you know, they'd say, God is playing to an audience that's too scared to laugh. But, you know, I get the joke. And, you know, so when I got sick when I was in my 40s, it was terrifying at first because I thought I was done with all that, and I knew it was going to mean cutting and hospitals and pain and all those things. And I was in a lab where they were making the pocket in my chest to put in a pacemaker, and this was the first serious cutting that they were doing outside of catheterizations, and I was terrified. I was just totally terrified, but I just started to count my blessings and to pray. And when I started to count my blessings and I realized I had lived way longer than anybody had ever thought, and I'd had a really good life. You know, I have a nice wife. I had a nice house, still have the house. You know, I had nice cars. I had friends. You know, I had a little pug that was peeing all over the house. I mean, everything was perfect. You know, what could I complain about? So even if I was supposed to go now, you know, I lived so much longer than they expected me to live. What could I complain about? And then suddenly my whole attitude turned to gratitude. And I keep that to now. And nothing fazes me anymore because it's all gravy. I can't complain when it's all gravy.
After your second transplant, you reached out to the family of the donor. Can you talk about their initial reaction?
Yeah, well, you know, that's a weird thing. Only 3% of the donor families respond to the letters. That most of us write a letter of thank you. There's too many people who don't write a letter of thank you, and I think that's awful. If any of you are listening, please write your letter. But, you know, I didn't expect to hear back. My first donor didn't write back or respond, and I sent them two letters. And most of them don't. Only 3% respond to a letter. And my donor, after a year, donor family, after a year, they responded. And and you have to go through the organ procurement organization, in this case is One Legacy in LA, and they called me up and they said, "Your donor family has a letter for you. Do you want it?" And I was like, "Oh my gosh, yes." And it took 3 weeks to get it to me. And then there was a handwritten note from my donor's mother. He had just gotten divorced, so the mother was the next of kin, not the wife. So he was 36 when he passed. His name was David Jacobo, and she told me about his children. But you can't say anything in the letters that could identify you. either direction. You can all, you know, I could say I lived in New York, but I couldn't say where in New York, and I couldn't use my name. I could say my name was Stephen, but I couldn't say my last name, and I couldn't give a phone number or an address. And they had the same prohibition. And so once I got their letter, and I responded to One Legacy that yes, I wanted. They had asked me three times in the letter if I'd like to meet them. And they didn't know I wasn't from California. They just assumed I was from California, which is the right that normally you would think that. But I went out from New York because New York is the worst state in the nation for donations. So there weren't enough hearts here for me to I wouldn't have lived through the wait. So so then it was One Legacy said, okay, now you can text each other. We weren't even allowed to call each other, but you're giving a phone number to text. So we started texting each other, and then we said, let's talk. And then I had an interview in L.A. and a wedding in L.A., and so I said, let's meet. And I flew out there, and my wife and I took an Uber to their house, and it was pretty weird and wonderful at the same time.
And you took a stethoscope with you. What was that experience like of them listening to his heart beating in your chest?
That is a very weird thing. He you know, when you die and you can become a donor, you don't outright die. You have to be on a ventilator, so the organs are perfused and there's still oxygen. So, I mean, he collapsed in his house from a brain aneurysm. He had just come home from work, and he collapsed right in front of his mother, his father, and his sister. And he was living there because he had just gotten divorced. And it was really weird to be in that place where he, you know, quote unquote died, and you know, in the house, and I know that, you know, they're looking at me going, oh my God, David's heart is in there, you know,
yeah.
And I'm walking around going, David, I'm carrying your heart around your house. It's very strange. It's very, very strange, but it's also wonderful. The family is incredibly loving. The mother and the ex-wife both told me I was family now separately, and they've acted like it. We're, you know, we talk and we write on Facebook to each other, and we talk occasionally, and I'm hoping to see them again fairly soon.
And yet there still has to be some level, I would think, of survivor guilt that goes with that.
Oh, a ton. But, you know, that's the way it is. I mean, I had horrible survivor's guilt after my first transplant. And, you know, that took me about 2 years to get over, maybe 3 years to get over, because I was also the vice president of Transplant Speakers International, and we were a very, very successful organization in the transplant world. And we trained about 8,000 people, and I probably trained 6,000 of them or 5,000 of them. And so I kept meeting all these families who had lost their loved ones, and the stories of how they lost their loved ones were, you know, you just can't believe all the weird ways people pass. And I'd come home from a weekend of being on the road talking with, you know, families, and I'd have to lay down for 2 or 3 days. I was so emotionally shot from it.
Yeah, you, I'm sure, are better equipped than most people to be able to answer this. How important is it to advocate for yourself in any kind of these medical situations?
Well, that's where I'm heading now. With I'm working with hospitals and everything now, just on that, because right now hospitals, patients, and doctors don't know how to talk to each other. They really don't. And you know, the common thing is a patient goes to a doctor and goes, "Doctor, I'm sick," and the doctor goes, "Yeah, you are," and the patient goes, "Cure me." Really, what it is the patient goes to the doctor, goes, "Doctor, I'm sick," and the doctor says, "Yeah, you are," and the patient should be going, help me cure me," because the patient is the one who does the curing, not the doctor. The doctor may give you the operation, he may give you the medicines, but everything they're doing is to promote healing. You have to do everything else, and most people don't recognize that. They don't recognize that they're the number one person in their healthcare team. And a lot of, you know, they'll fight with doctors and nurses. They'll be nasty. And really, is that the smartest thing you can do? That's like yelling at a cop. You know, why would you do that? It's really, you want every single person in that hospital to want to come into your room. You want, when you go to a doctor appointment, you want the doctor to want to see you. That's the way you get healthy. And when you're busy being nice like that, and when you're busy being really friendly to the doctors, being really open with them, and being grateful to them for what they're doing for you, it opens everything up. It opens up all the channels in you for you to heal, and they will work harder to try to get you to heal.
It's a
lot of people think, oh, they have to be nasty to their doctor or something. They have to be demanding. And that's not being your own advocate. That's being your own enemy.
It's a remarkable story. The book is called Grateful Guilt, Living in the Shadow of My Heart. Stephen Taibbi, thanks so much for joining us. We're very happy that you long exceeded that expiration date, and we wish you continued good health and success. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. I appreciate it.